He tried to think rationally about the tunnel. There was nothing in there that was going to bite him. He'd forgotten to pick up a good big flashlight. Christ, he never remembered everything. But he did have his butane Bic, and there was a guardrail between the catwalk and the road. No sweat, no strain. Anything else? Thinking about all those dead people in their cars, for instance. That was just panic talking, comic book stuff, about as sensible as worrying about the boogeyman in the closet. If that's all you can think about, Larry, he lectured himself, then you're not going to get along in this brave new world. Not at all. The stroke of lightning split the sky almost directly overhead, making him wince. It was followed by a heavy caisson of thunder. He thought randomly, July 1st. This is the day you're supposed to take your sweetie to Coney Island and eat hot dogs by the score. Knock down the 3 wooden milk bottles with one ball and win the Cupid doll. The fireworks at night. A cold splash of rain struck the side of his face, and then another hit the back of his neck and trickled inside the collar of his shirt. Dime-sized drops began to hit around him. He stood up, slung the pack over his shoulders, and hoisted the rifle. He was still not sure which way to go, back to 39th or into the Lincoln Tunnel. But he had to get under cover somewhere because it was starting to pour. The thunder broke overhead with a gigantic roar, making him squeal in terror, a sound no different than those made by Cro-Magnon men 2 million years before. "You fucking coward," he said, and trotted down the ramp toward the maw of the tunnel, his head bent forward as the rain began to come harder. It dripped from his hair. He passed the woman with her nose against the Eldorado's passenger window, trying not to look, but catching her out of the tail of his eye just the same. The rain drummed on the car roofs like percussion. It was coming down so hard it bounced back up again, causing a light mist haze. Larry stopped for a moment just outside the tunnel, undecided and frightened again. Then it began to hail, and that decided him. The hailstones were big, stinging. Thunder bellowed again. Okay, he thought. Okay, 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 I'm convinced. He stepped into the Lincoln Tunnel. It was much blacker inside than he had imagined somehow. At first, the opening behind him cast dim white light ahead, and he could see yet more cars, jammed in bumper to bumper. It must have been bad dying in here, he thought, as claustrophobia wrapped its stealthy banana fingers lovingly around his head and began to squeeze his temples. It must have been really bad. It must have been fucking horrible. And the greenish-white tiles that dressed the upward-curving walls. He could see the pedestrian railing to his right, stretching dimly ahead. On his left, at 30 or 40 foot intervals, were big support pillars. A sign advised him, "Do not change lanes." There were dark fluorescents embedded in the tunnel's roof, and the blank glass eyes of closed-circuit TV cameras. And as he negotiated the first slow, banked curve, bearing gently to the right, the light grew dimmer until all he could see were muted flashes of chrome. After that, the light simply ceased to exist at all. He fumbled out his Bic, held it up, and spun the wheel. The light it provided was pitifully small, feeding his unease rather than assuaging it. Even with the flame turned up all the way, it only gave him a circle of visibility about 6 feet in diameter. He put it back in his pocket and kept walking, trailing his hand lightly along the railing. There was an echo in here, too, one he liked even less than the one outside. The echo made it sound like someone was behind him, stalking him. He stopped several times, head cocked, eyes wide, but blind, listening until the echo had died off. After a bit, he began to shuffle so the echo wouldn't recur. Sometime after that, he stopped again and flicked the lighter close to his wristwatch. It was 4:20. But he wasn't sure what to make of that. In this blackness, time seemed to have no objective meaning. Neither did distance, for that matter. How long was the Lincoln Tunnel anyway? 1 mile? 2 miles? Surely it couldn't be 2 miles under the Hudson River. Let's say 1 mile. But if 1 mile was all it was, he should have been at the other end already. If the average man walks 4 miles an hour, he can walk 1 mile in 15 minutes, and he'd already been in this stinking hole 5 minutes longer than that. I'm walking a lot slower, he said, and jumped at the sound of his own voice. The lighter dropped from his hand and clicked onto the catwalk. The echo spoke back, changed into the dangerously jocular voice of an approaching lunatic. Ought slower, lower, lower. Jesus, Larry muttered, and the echo whispered back, zis, zis, zis. He wiped a hand across his face, fighting panic and the urge to give up thought and just run blindly forward. Instead, he knelt, his knees popped like pistol shots, frightening him again, and felt around over the miniature topography of the pedestrian catwalk, the chipped valleys in the cement, the ridge of an old cigarette butt, the hill of a tiny tinfoil ball, until at last he happened on his Bic. With an inner sigh, he squeezed it tightly in his hand, stood up, and walked on. Larry was beginning to get himself under control again when his foot struck something stiff and barely yielding. He uttered an inhalatory sort of scream and took two staggering steps backward. He made himself hold steady as he pulled the Bic lighter from his pocket and flicked it. The flame wavered crazily in his trembling grasp. He had stepped on a soldier's hand. He was sitting with his back against the tunnel wall, his legs splayed across the walkway, a horrible sentinel left here to bar passage. His glazed eyes stared up at Larry. His lips had fallen away from his teeth, and he seemed to be grinning. A switchblade knife was buried in his throat. The lighter was growing warm in his hand. Larry let it go out. Licking his lips, holding the railing in a death grip, he forced himself forward until the toe of his shoe struck the soldier's hand again. Then he stepped over, making a comically large stride, and a kind of nightmarish certainty came over him. He would hear the scrape of the soldier's boots as he shifted, then the soldier would reach out and grab his leg. In a shuffling sort of run, Larry went another 10 paces and then made himself stop, knowing that if he didn't stop, the panic would win and he would bolt blindly, chased by a terrible regiment of echoes. When he felt he had himself under some sort of control, he began to walk again. But now it was worse. His toes shrank inside his shoes, afraid that at any second they might come in contact with another body sprawled on the catwalk. And soon enough, it happened. He groaned and fumbled the lighter out again. This time it was much worse. The body his foot had struck was that of an old man in a blue suit. A black silk skullcap had fallen from his balding head into his lap. There was a 6-pointed star of beaten silver on his lapel. Beyond him were another 6 corpses. 2 women, a man of middle age, a woman who might have been in her late 70s, 2 teenage boys. The lighter was growing too hot to hold any longer. He snapped it off and slipped it back into his pants pocket, where it glowed like a warm coal against his leg. Captain Tripps hadn't taken this group off any more than it had taken the soldier back there. He had seen the blood, the torn clothes, the chipped tiles, the bullet holes. They had been gunned down. Larry remembered the rumors that soldiers had blocked off the points of exit. He hadn't known whether to believe them or not. He had heard so many rumors last week as things were breaking down. The situation here was easy enough to reconstruct. They had been caught in the tunnel, but they hadn't been too sick to walk. They got out of their car and began to make their way toward the Jersey side. There had been a command post, machine gun emplacement, something. Had been, or was now? Larry stood sweating, trying to make up his mind. The solid darkness provided the perfect theater screen on which the mind could play out its fantasies. He saw grim-eyed soldiers in germ-proof suits crouched behind a machine gun equipped with an infrared peeper scope, their job to cut down any stragglers who tried to come through the tunnel. A single soldier left behind, a suicide volunteer, wearing infrared goggles and creeping toward him with a knife in his teeth. 2 soldiers quietly loading a mortar with a single poison gas canister. Yet he couldn't bring himself to go back. He was quite sure that these imaginings were only vapors, and the thought of retracing his steps was just insupportable. Surely the soldiers were now gone. The dead one he'd stepped over seemed to support that, but... What was really troubling him, he supposed, were the bodies directly ahead. They were sprawled all over each other for 8 or 9 feet. He couldn't just step over them as he had stepped over the soldier. and if he went off the catwalk to go around them, he risked breaking his leg or his ankle. If he was going to go on, he would have to... walk over them. Behind, in the darkness, something moved. Larry wheeled around, instantly engulfed with fear at that single gritting sound. A footstep. "Who's there?" he shouted, unslinging his rifle. No answer but the echo. When it faded, he heard, or thought he did, the quiet sound of breathing. He stood bug-eyed in the dark, the hairs along the nape of his neck turning into hackles. He held his breath. There was no sound. He was beginning to dismiss it as imagination when the sound came again. A sliding, quiet footstep. He fumbled madly for his lighter. The thought that it would make him a target never occurred to him. As he pulled it from his pocket, the striker wheel caught in his pants momentarily, and the lighter tumbled from his hand. He heard a clink as it struck the railing, and then there was a soft bonk as it struck the hood or trunk of a car below. The sliding footstep came again, a little closer now, impossible to tell how close. Someone coming to kill him, and his terror-locked mind gave him a picture of the soldier with the switchblade in his neck, moving slowly toward him in the dark. That soft, gritting step again. Larry remembered the rifle. He threw the butt against his shoulder and began to fire. The explosions were shatteringly loud in the closed space. He screamed at the sound of them, but the scream was lost in the roar. Flashbulb images of tile and frozen lanes of traffic exploded one after another like a string of black-and-white snapshots as fire licked from the muzzle of the 30-30. Ricochets whined like banshees. The gun whacked his shoulder again and again until it was numb, until he knew that the force of the recoils had turned him on his feet and he was shooting out over the roadway instead of back along the catwalk. He was still unable to stop. His finger had taken over the function of the brain, and it spasmed mindlessly until the hammer began to fall with a dry and impotent clicking sound. The echoes rolled back. Bright afterimages hung before his eyes in triple exposures. He was faintly aware of the stench of cordite and of the whining sound he was making deep in his chest. Still clutching the gun, he whirled around again, and now it was not the soldiers in their sterile suits that he saw on the screen of his interior theater, but the Morlocks from the Classics Comics version of H.G. Wells's The Time Machine, humped and blind creatures coming out of their holes in the ground where engines ran on and on in the bowels of the earth. He began to struggle across the soft yet stiff barricade of bodies, stumbling, almost falling, clutching the railing, going on. His foot punched through into some dreadful sliminess, and there was a gassy, putrid smell that he barely noticed. He went on, gasping. Then from behind him, a scream rose in the darkness, freezing him on the spot. It was a desperate, wretched sound, close to the limits of sanity.
"Larry! Oh, Larry, for God's sake!"
It was Rita Blakemore. He turned around. There was sobbing now, wild sobbing that filled the place with fresh echoes. For one wild moment, he decided to go on anyway, to leave her. She would find a way out eventually. Why burden himself with her again? Then he got hold of himself and shouted, "Rita, stay where you are, do you hear me?" The sobbing continued. He stumbled back across the bodies, trying not to breathe, his face twisted in an expression of grimacing disgust. Then he ran toward her, not sure how far he had to go because of the distorting quality of the echo. In the end, he almost fell over her.
"Larry!"
She threw herself against him and clutched his neck with a strangler's force. He could feel her heart skidding along at a breakneck pace under her shirt.
"Larry, Larry, don't leave me alone here. Don't leave me alone in the dark."
"No." He held her tightly. "Did I hurt you? Are you shot?"
"No, I felt the wind. One of them went by so close I felt the wind of it. And chips, tile chips, I think, on my face. Cut my face." "Oh, Jesus, Rita, I didn't know. I was freaking out in there. The dark, and I lost my lighter. You should have called. I could have killed you."
The truth of it came home to him.
"I could have killed you,"
he repeated in stunned revelation.
"I wasn't sure it was you. I went into an apartment house when you went down the ramp, and you came back and called, and I almost... but I couldn't. And then two men came after the rain started. I think they were looking for us, or for me, so So I stayed where I was, and when they were gone, I thought, maybe they're hiding and looking for me, and I didn't dare go out until I started to think you'd get to the other side, and I'd never see you again, so I... Larry, you won't leave me, will you? You won't go away?
No, he said.
I was wrong, what I said. That was wrong. You were right. I should have told you about the sandals. I mean, the shoes. I'll eat when you tell me to. Oh.
Shh, he said, holding her. It's all right now. All right. But in his mind, he saw himself firing at her in a blind panic, and thought how easily one of those slugs could have smashed an arm or blown out her stomach. Suddenly, he had to go to the bathroom very badly, and his teeth wanted to chatter. We'll go when you feel like you can walk. Take your time.
There was a man. I think it was a man. I stepped on him, Larry.
She swallowed, and her throat clicked.
Oh, I almost screamed then, but I didn't, because I thought it might be one of those men up ahead instead of you. And when you called out, the echo, I couldn't tell if it was you or...
There are more dead people up ahead. Can you stand that?
If you're with me. Please, if you're with me.
I will be.
Let's go, then. I want to get out of here.
She shuddered convulsively against him.
I never wanted anything so badly in my life.
They got over the bodies, their arms slung about each other's necks like drunken chums coming home from a neighborhood tavern. Beyond that, they came to a blockage of some sort. It was impossible to see, but after running her hands over it, Rita said it might be a bed standing on end. Together, they managed to tip it over the catwalk railing. It crashed onto a car below with a loud, echoing bang that made them both jump and clutch each other. Behind where it had been, there were more sprawled bodies, three of them, and Larry guessed that these were the soldiers that had shot down the Jewish family. They got over them and went on, holding hands. A short time later, Rita stopped short.
What's the matter? Larry asked. Is there something in the way? No. I can see, Larry. It's the end of the tunnel.
He blinked and realized that he could see, too. The glow was dim, and it had come so gradually that he hadn't been aware of it until Rita had spoken. He could make out a faint shine on the tiles and the pale blur of Rita's face closer by. Looking over to the left, he could see the dead river of automobiles.
Come on, he said, jubilant.
60 paces further along, there were more bodies sprawled on the walkway, all soldiers. They stepped over them.
Why would they only close off New York, she asked. Unless, maybe... Larry, maybe it only happened in New York.
I don't think so, he said, but felt a touch of irrational hope anyway. They walked faster. The mouth of the tunnel was ahead of them now. It was blocked by two huge army convoy trucks parked nose to nose. The trucks blotted out much of the daylight. If they hadn't been there, Larry and Rita would have had some light much further back in the tunnel. There was another sprawl of bodies where the catwalk descended to join the ramp leading outside. They squeezed between the convoy trucks, scrambling over the locked bumpers. Rita didn't look inside, but Larry did. There was a half-assembled tripod machine gun, boxes of ammunition, and canisters of stuff that looked like tear gas. Also, three dead men. As they came outside, a rain-dampened breeze pressed against them, and its wonderfully fresh smell seemed to make it all worth it. He said so to Rita, and she nodded and put her head against his shoulder for a moment.
I wouldn't go through there again for $1 million, she said.
In a few years, you'll be using money for toilet paper, he said. Please don't squeeze the greenbacks.
But are you sure
that it wasn't just New York? He pointed. Look. The toll booths were empty. The middle one stood like a sentinel rising from a pile of broken glass. Beyond them, the westbound lanes were empty for as far as they could see, but the eastbound lanes were crowded with silent traffic. There was an untidy pile of bodies in the breakdown lane, and a number of seagulls stood watch over it.
Oh, dear God, she said weakly.
There were as many people trying to get into New York as there were trying to get out of it. I don't know why they bothered blockading the tunnel on the Jersey end. Probably they didn't either, just somebody's bright idea, busy work. but she had sat down on the road and was crying. "Don't," he said, kneeling beside her. The experience in the tunnel was still too fresh for him to feel angry with her. "It's all right, Rita."
"What is?" she sobbed. "What is? Just tell me one thing."
"We're out anyway. That's something. And there's fresh air. In fact, New Jersey never smelled so good." That earned him a wan smile. Larry looked at the scratches on her cheek and temple where the shards of tile had cut her. "We ought to get you to a drugstore and put some peroxide on those," he said. "Do you feel up to walking?"
"Yes."
She was looking at him with a dumb gratitude that made him feel uneasy. "And I'll get some new shoes, some sneakers. I'll do just what you tell me, Larry. I want to." "I shouted at you because I was upset," he said quietly. He brushed her hair back and kissed one of the scratches over her right eye. "I'm not such a bad guy," he added quietly.
"Just don't leave me."
He helped her to her feet and slipped an arm around her waist. Then they walked slowly toward the toll booths and slipped through them, New York behind them and across the river. Chapter 28. There was a small park in the center of a gunquit, complete with a Civil War cannon and a war memorial. And after Gus Dinsmore died, Franny Goldsmith went there and sat beside the duck pond, idly throwing stones in and watching the ripples spread in the calm water until they reached the lily pads around the edges and broke up in confusion. She had begun nursing Gus the day before yesterday, had sat with him through the deliriums, the false signs of recovery, and the final coma, in Gus's case, mercifully short. He had died at 7:45 this morning, only an hour and a half ago. He had been rational at the end, but unaware of just how serious his condition was. He had told her longingly that he'd like to have an ice cream soda, the kind his daddy had treated Gus and his brothers to every 4th of July and again at Labor Day when the fair came to Bangor. But the power was off in the gunquit by then. It had gone at exactly 9:17 p.m. on the evening of June 28th by the electric clocks. And there was no ice cream to be had in a gunquit. She had wondered if someone in town might not have a gasoline generator with a freezer hooked up to it on an emergency circuit, and even thought of hunting up Harold Lauder to ask him. But then Gus began to breathe his final whooping, hopeless breaths. That went on for 5 endless minutes while she held his head up with one hand and the cloth under his mouth with the other to catch the thick expectorations of mucus. Then it was over. Franny covered him with a clean sheet and had left him on old Jack Green's bed, which overlooked the ocean. Then she had come here and, since then, had been tossing rocks into the pond, not thinking about much of anything. But she unconsciously realized that it was a good kind of not thinking. It wasn't like that strange apathy that had shrouded her on the day after her father had died. Since then, she had been more and more herself. She had gotten a rosebush down at Nathan's House of Flowers and had carefully planted it at the foot of Peter's grave. She thought it would take hold real well, as her father would have said. Her lack of thought now was a kind of rest, after seeing Gus through the last of it. It was nothing like the prelude to madness she had gone through before. That had been like passing through some gray, foul tunnel full of shapes more sensed than seen. It was a tunnel she never wanted to travel again. But she would have to think soon about what to do next. And she supposed that thinking would have to include Harold Lauder, not just because she and Harold were now the last two people in the area, but because she had no idea what would become of Harold without someone to watch out for him. She didn't suppose that she was the world's most practical person, but since she was there, she would have to do it. She still didn't particularly like him, but at least he had tried to be tactful and had turned out to have some decency, quite a bit, even, in his own queer way. Harold had left her alone since their meeting 4 days ago, probably respecting her wish to grieve for her parents. But she had seen him from time to time in Roy Brannigan's Cadillac, cruising aimlessly from place to place. And twice, when the wind was right, she had been able to hear the clacking of his typewriter from her bedroom window. The fact that it was quiet enough to hear that sound, although the Lauder house was nearly a mile and a half away, seemed to underline the reality of what had happened. She was a little amused that although Harold had latched onto the Cadillac, he hadn't thought of replacing his manual typewriter with one of those quiet, humming electric torpedoes. Not that he could have it now, she thought as she stood up and brushed off the seat of her shorts. Ice cream and electric typewriters were a thing of the past. It made her feel sadly nostalgic, and she found herself wondering again with a sense of deep bewilderment how such a cataclysm could have taken place in only a couple of weeks. There would be other people, no matter what Harold said. If the system of authority had temporarily broken down, they would just have to find the scattered others and reform it. It didn't occur to her to wonder why authority seemed to be such a necessary thing to have, any more than it occurred to her to wonder why she had automatically felt responsible for Harold. It just was. Structure was a necessary thing. She left the park and walked slowly down Main Street toward the Lauder house. The day was warm already, but the air was freshened by a sea breeze. She suddenly wanted to go down to the beach, find a nice piece of kelp, and nibble on it. "God, you're disgusting," she said aloud. Of course, she was pregnant. That was part of it. Next week, it would be a Bermuda onion sandwich with creamy horseradish on top. She stopped on the corner, still a block from Harold's, surprised at how long it had been since she had thought of her delicate condition. Before, she had always been discovering that I'm pregnant thought around odd corners, like some unpleasant mess she kept forgetting to clean up. I ought to be sure and get that blue dress to the cleaners before Friday. A few more months and I can hang it in the closet because I'm pregnant. I guess I'll take my shower now. In a few months, it'll probably look like there's a whale in the shower stall because I'm pregnant. I ought to get the oil changed in the car before the pistons fall right out of their sockets or whatever. And I wonder what Johnny would say if he knew I'm pregnant. But maybe now she had become accustomed to the thought. After all, she was nearly 3 months along, nearly a third of the way there. For the first time, she wondered with some unease who would help her have her baby. From behind the Lauder house, there came a steady ratcheting click, click, click of a hand mower. And when Fran came around the corner, what she saw was so strange that only her complete surprise kept her from laughing out loud. Harold, clad only in a tight and skimpy blue bathing suit, was mowing the lawn. His white skin was sheened with sweat. His long hair flopped against his neck, although to do Harold credit, it did appear to have been washed in the not-too-distant past. The rolls of fat above the waistband of his trunks and below the leg bands jounced up and down wildly. His feet were green with cut grass to above the ankle. His back had gone reddish, although with exertion or incipient sunburn, she couldn't tell. But Harold wasn't just mowing, he was running. The Lauder's back lawn sloped down to a picturesque, rambling stone wall, and in the middle of it was an octagonal summer house. She and Amy used to hold their teas there when they were little girls, Franny remembered with a sudden stab of nostalgia that was unexpectedly painful. Back in the days when they could still cry over the ending of Charlotte's Web and moan happily over Chucky Mayo, who was the cutest boy in school. The Lauder's lawn was somehow English in its greenness and its peace, but now a dervish in a blue bathing suit had invaded this pastoral scene. She could hear Harold panting in a way that was alarming to listen to as he turned the northeast corner where the Lauder's back lawn was divided from the Wilsons by a row of mulberry bushes. He roared down the slope of the lawn, bent over the mower's T-handle. The blades whirred, grass flew in a green jet, coating Harold's lower legs. He had mowed perhaps half of the lawn. What was left was a diminishing square with the summer house in the middle. He turned the corner at the bottom of the hill and then roared back, for a moment obscured from view by the summer house, and then reappearing, bent over his machine like a race driver. About halfway up, he saw her. At exactly the same instant, Franny said timidly, "Harold?" And she saw that he was in tears. "Huh?" Harold said. She had startled him out of some private world, and for a moment she feared that the startle on top of his exertion would give him a heart attack. Then he ran for the house, his feet kicking through drifts of mown grass, and she was peripherally aware of the sweet smell it made on the hot summer air. She took a step after him. "Harold, what's wrong?" Then he was bounding up the porch steps. The back door opened, Harold ran inside, and it slammed behind him with a jarring crash. In the silence that descended afterward, a jay called stridently, and some small animal made rattling noises in the bushes behind the stone wall. The mower, abandoned, stood with cut grass behind it and high grass before it, a little way from the summer house, where she and Amy had once drunk their Kool-Aid in Barbie's kitchen cups, with their little fingers sticking elegantly off into the air. Franny stood indecisive for a while, and at last walked up to the door and knocked. There was no answer, but she could hear Harold crying somewhere inside. Harold? No answer. The weeping went on. She let herself into the Lauders' back hall, which was dark, cool, and fragrant. Mrs. Lauder's cold pantry opened off the hall to the left, and for as long as Franny could remember, there had been the good smell of dried apples and cinnamon back here, like pies dreaming of creation. Harold? She walked up the hall to the kitchen, and Harold was there, sitting at the table. His hands were clutched in his hair, and his green feet rested on the faded linoleum that Mrs. Lauder had kept so spotless. Harold, what's wrong?
Go away, he yelled tearfully. Go away, you don't like me.
Yes, I do. You're okay, Harold. Maybe not great, but okay. This seemed to make Harold cry harder. Do you have something to drink?
Kool-Aid, he said.
He sniffed, wiped his nose, and still looking at the table, added, It's warm. Of course it is. Did you get the water at the town pump? Like many small towns, Ogunquit still had a common pump in back of the town hall, although for the last 40 years it had been more of an antiquity than a practical source of water. Tourists sometimes took pictures of it. This is the town pump in the little seaside town where we spent our vacation. Oh, isn't that quaint? Yeah, that's where I got it. She poured them each a glass and sat down. We should be having it in the summer house, she thought. Harold, what's wrong? Harold uttered a strange, hysterical laugh and fumbled his Kool-Aid to his mouth. He drained the glass and set it down.
Wrong? Now, what could be wrong?
I mean, is it something specific? She tasted her Kool-Aid and fought down a grimace. It wasn't that warm. Harold must have drawn the water only a short time ago, but he had forgotten the sugar. He looked up at her finally, his face tear-streaked and still wanting to blubber.
I want my mother, he said simply.
Oh, Harold.
I thought when it happened, when she died. Now, that wasn't so bad.
He was gripping his glass, staring at her in an intense, haggard way that was a little frightening.
I know how terrible that must sound to you, but I never knew how I would take it when they passed away. I'm a very sensitive person. That's why I was so persecuted by the cretins at that house of horrors the town fathers saw fit to call a high school. I thought it might drive me mad with grief, their passing, or at least prostrate me for a year. My interior son, so to speak, would... And when it happened, my mother, Amy, my father, I said to myself, now that wasn't so bad.
He brought his fist down on the table, making her flinch.
Why can't I say what I mean? He cried. I've always been able to say what I mean. It's a writer's job to carve with language, to hew close to the bone, so why can't I say what it feels like?
Harold, don't. I know how you feel. He stared at her, dumbstruck.
You know?
He shook his head.
No, you couldn't.
Remember when you came to the house and I was digging the grave? I was half out of my mind. Half the time I couldn't even remember what I was doing. I tried to cook some French fries and almost burned the house down. So if it makes you feel better to mow the grass, fine. You'll get a sunburn if you do it in your bathing trunks, though. You're already getting one, she added critically, looking in his shoulders. To be polite, she sipped a little more of the dreadful Kool-Aid. He wiped his hand across his mouth.
I never even liked them that well, he said. But I thought grief was something you felt anyway. Like your bladder's full, you have to urinate.
and if close relatives die, you have to be grief-stricken. She nodded, thinking that was strange, but rather apt. My mother was always taken with Amy. She was Amy's friend, he amplified with unconscious and nearly pitiful childishness. And I horrified my father. Fran saw how that could be. Brad Lauder had been a huge, brawny man, a foreman at the woolen mill in Kennebunk. He would have had very little idea of what to make of the fat, peculiar son that his loins had produced. He took me aside once, Harold resumed, and asked me if I was a queer boy. That's just how he said it. I got so scared I cried, and he slapped my face and told me if I was going to be such a goddamned baby all the time, I'd best ride right out of town. And Amy, I think it would be safe to say that Amy just didn't give a shit. I was just an embarrassment when she brought her friends home. She treated me like I was a messy room. With an effort, Fran finished her Kool-Aid. So when they were gone and I didn't feel too much one way or the other, I just thought I was wrong. Grief is not a knee-jerk reaction, I said to myself. But I got fooled. I missed them more and more every day, mostly my mother. If I could just see her. A lot of times, she wasn't around when I wanted her, needed her. She was too busy doing things for Amy, or with Amy, but she was never mean to me. So this morning, when I got thinking about it, I said to myself, I'll mow the grass, then I won't think of it. But I did. She reached across the table and touched his hand. There's nothing wrong with the way you feel, Harold. Are you sure? He was looking at her again in that wide-eyed, childish stare. Yes. Will you be my friend? Yes. Thank God, Harold said. Thank God for that. His hand was sweaty in hers, and as she thought it, he seemed to sense it and pulled his hand reluctantly away. Would you like some more Kool-Aid? He asked her humbly. She smiled her best diplomatic smile. Maybe later, she said. They had a picnic lunch in the park, peanut butter and jelly sandwiches, Hostess Twinkies, and a large bottle of Coke each. The Cokes were fine after they had been cooled in the duck pond. I've been thinking about what I'm going to do, Harold said. Don't you want the rest of that Twinkie? No, I'm full. Her Twinkie disappeared into Harold's mouth in a single bite. His belated grief hadn't affected his appetite, Franny observed, and then decided that was a rather mean thing to think. What? She said. I was thinking of going to Vermont, he said diffidently. Would you like to come? Why Vermont? There's a government plague and communicable diseases center down there, in a town called Stovington, Harold said. It's not as big as the one in Atlanta, but it's sure a lot closer. I was thinking that if there are still people alive and working on this flu, a lot of them would be there. Why wouldn't they be dead, too? Well, they might be, Harold said, rather prissily. But in places like Stovington, where they're used to dealing with communicable diseases, they're also used to taking precautions, and if they are still in operation, I would imagine they are looking for people like us, people who are immune. How do you know all that, Harold? She was looking at him with open admiration, and Harold blushed happily. I read a lot. Neither of those places are secret. So what do you think, Fran? She thought it was a wonderful idea. It appealed to that uncoalesced need for structure and authority. She immediately dismissed Harold's disclaimer that they might all be dead. They would get to Stovington, they would be taken in, tested, and out of all the tests would come some discrepancy, some difference between them and all the people who had gotten sick and died. It didn't occur to her just then to wonder what earthly good a vaccine could do at this point. I think we ought to find a road atlas and see how to get there as quick as we can, she said. His face lit up. For a moment she thought he was going to kiss her, and in that single shining moment she probably would have allowed it. But then the moment passed. In retrospect, she was glad. By the road atlas, where all distance was reduced to finger lengths, it looked simple enough. Number 1 to I-95, I-95 to US 302, and then northwest on 302 through the lake country towns of western Maine, across the Chimney of New Hampshire on the same road, and then into Vermont. Stovington was only 30 miles west of Barrie, accessible either by Vermont Route 61 or I-89. "How far is that altogether?" Fran asked. Harold got a ruler, measured, and then consulted the mileage scale. "You won't believe this," he said glumly. "What is it, 100 miles? "Over 300. "Oh, God," Franny said. "That kills my idea. I thought we could hike it." "I was thinking of bikes," Harold said. Or maybe motor scooters." "Harold," she said solemnly, "you're a genius." Harold coughed, blushing and pleased again. "We could bike as far as Wells tomorrow morning. There's a Honda dealership there. Can you drive a Honda, Fran?" "I can learn if we can go slow for a while." "Oh, I think it would be very unwise to speed," Harold said seriously. "One would never know when one would come around a blind curve and find a 3-car smash-up blocking the road." "Why wait until tomorrow? Why don't we go today?" "Well, it's past 2 now," he said. "We couldn't get much further than Wells, and we'd need to outfit ourselves. That would be easier to do here in Ogunquit, because we know where everything is. And we'll need guns, of course." It was queer, really. As soon as he mentioned that word, she had thought of the baby. "Why do we need guns?" He looked at her for a moment, then dropped his eyes. A red blush was creeping up his neck. "Because the police and courts are gone, and you're a woman and you're pretty, and some people, some men, might not be gentlemen, that's why." His blush was so red now it was almost purple. "He's talking about rape," she thought. "Rape. But how could anyone want to rape me? I'm pregnant." But no one knew that, not even Harold. "And even if you spoke up, said to the intended rapist, 'Will you please not do that because I'm pregnant?' Could you reasonably expect the rapist to reply, 'Geez, lady, I'm sorry, I'll go rape some other girl.'" "All right," she said, "guns. But we could still get as far as Wells today." "There's something else I want to do here," Harold said.